The Blaze Radio Network. On demand.
The more the world changes, the more we find comfort in things that never change. This is Rabbi Daniel Lappin On Demand on the Blaze Radio Network.
Welcome, everybody, to the Rabbi Daniel Lappin Show, where your rabbi reveals how the world really works. And one of the ways the world really works is that people find themselves a religion. Very few people are truly atheistic. There are some, I even know one or two, but the overwhelming majority of people, when they abandon one religion, they usually adopt another, even though the religion they adopt is frequently camouflaged, seldom recognized for the religion that it really is. Now, what is it that defines a religion? Well, I've always had considerable difficulty understanding how Scientology is classified as a religion, because the means by which Scientology obtained the classification for legal and tax purposes was by arguing that they help people get in touch with their true non-material natures. They help people become aware of spiritual realities. Well, if that's what it takes, then welcome to the religion of the Rabbi Daniel Lappin Show, because a frequent topic under discussion right here is that very one. In other words, I don't really think you need a religion to be aware that human beings are largely spiritual. It's something I've spoken of before. The very fact that we make decisions that have no economic sense. You know, the person, I used to say the woman, but now I'm only going to say the person who drives to the other side of town to fill the car with gas because the gas is 7 cents a gallon less expensive there, when the cost of the gas to get to the other side of town and back utterly wipes out any potential loss, any potential gain on that. There are people who do that anyways, right? That's just one example. There are many, many other examples that you and I do on a regular basis, where we make decisions to do things that are not in our very best economic interests. And the answer that we give is that money isn't everything. I'm willing to spend money in order to gain certain non-material benefits. And each and every one of us have our own examples of where we do that. The very fact that we depend on friendship, we need the love of other people. All of these things are examples, and there are so many, many others, that we do, in fact, have a spiritual reality. So much so that when I usually say that we are a combination of body and soul, I'm often corrected with the words, and I think they're the words of C.S. Lewis, that not that we are a body with a soul, but we are a soul with a body. In other words, the critical part of us is actually our spiritual entity rather than our physical and material entity. And needless to say, I do agree that a strong case can be made for that very argument. So what is a religion then? Well, I think by the correct definitions of a religion, I don't know that Scientology actually makes it, but that's neither here nor there, because secular fundamentalism definitely makes it, and that is exactly the point that we're discussing today. I had said in last week's show, I'd spoken about the fact that modern progressivism, what passes for leftist politics, progressive politics, the whole political environment of the aggressive left today, both in the United States and Europe. I argued that it's much more than merely a sick, evil, and twisted pathology. It's not a political system anymore. It is actually an evil religion. Yes, not all religions are true. Not all religions are good. And I felt that this was one that wasn't. So what is it that makes a religion then? A number of people asked me during the week, what is it that makes a religion that you can actually claim that progressive politics is a religion much more than a political dogma? And the answer, I think, is several things. First of all, there is an explicit deity. Right, it's not a deity mentioned in vague terms, because if that were the case, Alcoholics Anonymous, which is a very fine organization, would be a religion. It isn't. Right, they speak of a higher power, but when you are willing to speak more explicitly about this outside force, then that's one thing. Number two, and most importantly, it makes demands of you. And that's another area in which Scientology fails the religion test, as far as I'm concerned, because the deity of Scientology is loosely referred to, if at all, and it certainly makes no explicit demands on you other than being a good human being and so on and so forth. But in a religion, the deity of a religion makes very specific demands, as it does in Islam, for instance. Nobody can dispute that Islam is a religion. And so that is the second point. The third is a three-part, and perhaps the most important of all. A religion provides a picture of where we came from, what our ultimate destiny is, and what exactly we're supposed to be doing in the interim. That's what a religion does. And the biblical religions of Judaism and Christianity do those things very explicitly. It always amuses me to realize that those questions, when you get right down to it, are very fundamental questions that relate to our identity in the deepest possible way. In that, I've always noticed that either little kids or people who are utterly uninhibited generally ask those questions. If you sit next to a stranger on a plane, you start talking, and generally what you're each trying to find out about each other is, where are you from, where are you headed, and what do you do? With women, I usually add one more, and that is, are you attached? Right. In other words, if a man and a woman start talking, invariably, it may not come to the surface. The man may know that he has to watch his P's and Q's these days, but almost invariably, one of the things that a man who's talking to a woman wants to know is whether she's attached. What are her family connections? When you talk to a man, whether or not he's married crops up really very late in the conversation. Much before that are where are you from, where are you headed to, and what is it that you do in the interim? What do you do? That is the question. Those are the three questions. So, the biblical faiths of Judaism and Christianity tend to answer those very, very simply, right? Where are we from as human beings? Well, right, you've got to be able to answer this question as a religion of how come we're on this little planet, this negligible speck of dust in a remote solar system on the corner of a lost galaxy. It's really a bizarre kind of thing. And as we've often spoken about on the program, in spite of the fact that statistically you'd say that we have to have encountered thousands of other planets where similar development has taken place, to the present, we haven't. And that is an incredibly disturbing thing to people who professionally contemplate these ideas. So, you know, where, according to Judeo-Christian ethics where, and belief systems, where do we come from? It's very simple, right? A good and loving God created us in his image and he put us here. Okay, fine. How about where are we headed to? Well, again, I think both Jews and Christians would agree on some formulation of this answer. They'd probably have to sit down and chat about it for a little bit and work on it. But basically, you know, on some great day of God's choosing, a glorious redemption takes place and humanity moves on to a new level of connection with the Creator, something like that. And what are we supposed to be doing in the interim? We're supposed to be furthering God's plans for his kingdom on earth. Again, play with the words a little bit if you like, but no Jew and no Christian would have any confusion at all about what the answer to that third question is. And again, if you have these three things in place, that pretty much defines a religion. When we come back, let me show you what we have when it comes to one of the most active religions in the United States of America, and one that, contrary to the Constitution, gains enormous governmental support, and that is the religion of secular fundamentalism. Meanwhile, the website, as always, is RabbiDanielLappin.com, RabbiDanielLappin.com. And the resource I draw your attention to for a possible transaction between us today is Day for Atonement. And you can read about it. I won't take time now, but you can read about it on the website, Day for Atonement at RabbiDanielLappin.com. And it's significant, I think, just because this particular show is dated. This show airs just after the Jewish holiday of Rosh Hashanah in the year 5778, which is, of course, late 2017, September 2017. But with the holiday of New Year or Rosh Hashanah just passed, the next holiday on the calendar in just a few days' time is Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. And this audio CD gives some of the deeper and more universal aspects of what atonement is all about and what it really does mean. We also have a couple of new videos on the website that address the idea of some of these biblical festivals for those of you who are interested. Okay, quick break. I'm Rabbi Daniel Lappin, and I'll be right back with you.
Ancient solutions to modern problems. This is Rabbi Daniel Lappin, on demand on the Blaze Radio Network.
The progressive movement is full of lies. Why do Americans keep falling for the deception? In his new book, Liars, Glenn Beck reveals the simple answer, fear.
At our most basic level, we're all afraid of something, and progressives exploit this by offering us solutions to our fears. Solutions based on lies and an unrelenting hunger for power and control. Understanding the roots of these lies is key to helping us stop the disease of progressivism.
Liars by Glenn Beck. On sale now at glennbeck.com/liars.
Rabbi Daniel Lappin returns with more of how the world really works on the Blaze Radio Network On Demand.
Hi, everybody, and welcome back to the Rabbi Daniel Lappin Show, where your rabbi devotes himself to raising anybody from despair and dependency up to dignity and discipline. That's the secret of building a life purposefully. And we talk about that and a whole lot of other things, but right now, focusing on the reality that progressive politics is actually a religion. It's not a political system. It's not a political ideology. It's not just another way of looking at politics. Not at all. Not at all. It is, at its root, a religion. And in the last segment, what I tried to do was to give you the definition of a religion. I'm now going to use that definition and apply it to the world of progressive politics, the political system that I call the religion of secular fundamentalism. And yes, it is a religion with a lot of fundamentalists, and it is a religion of secularism. Let's first of all ask ourselves, does it have a deity? And I think it does. I think it has a deity that has surfaced many times before in the long story of human civilization, and that is the deity of nature, pantheism, the environment. This is a god, or the earth. And it is a god for huge numbers of people, not only in the United States, but also in Europe. It is very much a god. It is very explicitly identified. People speak about it all the time. And the second requirement is that it must require, it must demand certain behavior from you for it to be a religion. And sure enough, you know, Allah demands certain behavior from Muslims that includes killing infidels, Judaism and Christianity both have behaviors demanded from their adherents by the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And don't for a moment think that the religion of secular fundamentalism's God, you know, pantheism, the nature, the environment, the earth, there are many different names for their God, just as there are many different names for the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, right? In the Hebrew, there are a number of different names, possibly as many as 72, but that would take us into a different conversation. Right now, at any rate, we see that in the even in the story of creation, in the first few chapters of Genesis, we find the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, you know, referred to as God, the Lord, etc. And in Hebrew, those are specific words. Anyways, not for now. Point being that it's perfectly normal for a God to be known by a number of different names. That doesn't make it different gods. It's just a god known by a number of different names, where each name highlights a different aspect of the god. And the religion of secular fundamentalism in this respect obviously is no different. It's, you know, it's the earth, it's the environment, it's nature, it's whatever it is. But that we all know exactly what it's talking about. Does it? Item number two is, does it demand specific behavior? You bet it does. It requires that you don't ask your hotel to replace your linen and towels every day. It requires that you don't use a lot of gasoline, and you must drive an electrical car. That's one of the sacred sacraments of secular fundamentalism, is you must drive an electric car. And there's so many others. I would say that there are probably more commandments in the religion of secular fundamentalism than there are in the Torah. The Torah has only 613 commandments. I'm sure there are considerably more than that in the religion of secular fundamentalism. And then finally, in order to be a religion, it has to answer the three existential questions of life. Where did we come from? Where are we headed? And what are we supposed to be doing in between? And sure enough, it does exactly those things as well. How does secular fundamentalism ask where we came from? Very simple. And by the way, this is treated as doctrine, and heretics are punished severely. We are here, says secular fundamentalism, because primitive protoplasm, over the course of many, many years, changed and became turned into plumbers and proctologists. Primitive protoplasm became Bach and Beethoven. Primitive protoplasm became authors and car mechanics. All of that came about just through a lengthy process of methane gases being struck by electricity and the process of natural selection that produced everything we see today from absolute nothing at all. In other words, in a process of unaided materialistic evolution, nothing became something. And that is doctrinaire. So much so that there are many high priests of secular fundamentalism who get so agitated when people want to discuss a divine origin of the universe that they launch lawsuits. And so you have the bizarre sight of secular fundamentalist high priests in New York literally taking parishes in Louisiana to court because the schools in that parish teach the alternative religion explanation of how we came to be here, namely that the good Lord created us in his image and put us here. Only a religion treats dissenters as heretics. A science looks at dissenters as valuable collaborators and colleagues. We're happy that you dissent, and we want to now, since we are in desirous of pursuing the truth, we want to explore. We'll do experiments to see, are you right? Am I right? In the world of science, dissenters are welcomed. But in the world of religion, dissenters are treated as heretics. And so in the religion of secular fundamentalism, anybody who denies that particular explanation of the origin of human beings on this planet is treated very severely. It stops short of burning them at the stake, but it does include stripping them of their livelihood, getting them fired, particularly in the academic environment. The force of the religion of secular fundamentalism is enormous because it's managed to co-opt the state. In gross violation of the Constitution, the state does support the religion of secular fundamentalism, and it supports it very strongly. The second answer that a religion has to give is the answer of, where are we headed to? And once again, whereas Judeo-Christian faiths speak of and believe in a glorious future where God will come to the rescue of mankind, secular fundamentalism obviously believes that since there is no God and he's not going to come to the rescue of mankind, obviously the end of the story has to be gruesome and horrible and terrible. And so the religion of secular fundamentalism creates all kinds of scenarios for the end of days. Years and years ago, it used to be nuclear winter, and the world is cooling off. By the way, this is not so long ago as to be outside the memory range of I'm sure many listeners. For younger people, you're probably going to raise your eyebrows in amazement and say, "What, did people really once believe that the world was cooling off and we were all going to be heading to another ice age?" Yes, absolutely. Not long ago at all, they did. It doesn't matter, because in secular fundamentalism, the end of the story has to be gloom and hopelessness and disaster and calamity. That's what it's all about. It's global warming, climate change. We're going to run out of space and we're all going to die in a rising tide of disposable diapers because we're using up space. One of the high priests of secular fundamentalism is a professor at Stanford University, Paul Ehrlich, who in the 60s and early 70s wrote about how all humanity is going to hit a time of terrible starvation. Millions of people, including Americans, will die of starvation before the 21st century, by the way. He has already been proven wrong, and he's still teaching in the sanctum sanctorum of Stanford University. Why? Because it's not about science. It's about religion. And there have been many, many, you know, William Miller was in the 19th century, upstate New York, gathered huge numbers of people in fields to listen to speeches and to welcome the end of days. And when the end of days didn't happen on the date he specified, that didn't destroy the religion. It just changed things around a little bit. That's how it is with religions. And when Paul Ehrlich made a prediction that how soon doom would strike humanity, he didn't lose his job. He's still teaching at Stanford, in spite of the fact, well, because it's not about science, it's about a religion. And the religion of secular fundamentalism insists, as it must, that the end of humanity is doom and gloom, terror and hopelessness. They even make religious movies, by the way. Look this one up. It's not been in theaters for years, but you'll catch it on reruns on late night television. And it was called Armageddon. It was about a meteorite that was hurtling towards the Earth and was going to destroy the Earth. Any movies about the end of days, that destruction are coming, and even, by the way, I suspect zombie movies are probably also religious in nature, but the Armageddon had Saint Bruce Willis saving humanity. And that's the nature of religious movies. The third question religions have to answer is, what are we supposed to be doing between our arrival and our departure? And the answer, obviously, is trying to avert the dangers of question number two, whether now it's climate change, used to be global warming, whatever it is, it makes absolutely no difference. It's not about science, even though they will cite 97% of scientists agree, and it's all rubbish, but it doesn't make any difference because we're talking about religious dogma, we're not talking about science. You can produce as many qualified and credible scientists, of whom there is a huge number, who utterly dispel the myth of climate change and global warming. And many of them, by the way, have paid the price as heretics of not being burned at the stake, but being professionally cut off and having their funding removed. It's a very serious business, because when you aggravate the religious authorities of the day, your life can really be impacted, as people like Galileo and many, many other great scientists of the past discovered. Well, today, many great scientists are being severely penalized for denying, as to use the language of the religion of secular fundamental. They are deniers. What scientific community has ever called somebody who disagrees with a theory a denier? Right? But that's because it's not about science. It's about a religion. And so what is the what are we the third answer? Yeah, you've got to be working in any way you can to avert the dangers of answer number two. You've got to fight global warming. You've got to fight shortage. And that's another thing, by the way. One of the doctrines of secular fundamentalism is you have to recycle. That's a sacred sacrament, because there's shortage everywhere. Needless to say, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob is a God of enormous abundance. The God of secular fundamentalism is a shrinking God of shortage, angry at humanity, always trying to diminish the ability of human beings to enjoy the abundance that is available. So you've got to do all of these things. You've got to turn not to the big G of God, but to the little G of government, because many things that have to be done in order to avert the terrors and dangers of answer number two are too much for an individual to do. Your children are being indoctrinated at government indoctrination camps, otherwise known as public schools, to buy into this and to be part of it and to report their parents who are not recycling and doing enough. In many jurisdictions, Seattle just had a lawsuit about this, many jurisdictions, they dispatch religious police to check your garbage, to make sure you are putting the recycling things in the right containers. Really, this sounds ridiculous, right? I mean, you thought only in Iran do religious police go around checking up on people. No, Seattle also, and many other jurisdictions around the country as well. There is no question about it. Secular fundamentalism, progressive politics, a religion, not in any way a political theory or political view, not at all. Okay, so that then explains the whole point about secular fundamentalism, the politics of the left being a religion. When we come back, we have an interesting thing. I'm interviewing a woman called Judy Gruen. Now, how often do I interview people on this show, right? Not very often at all. But I did this time. Why? Well, because she gave me an unusual gift, and that is seeing myself through someone else's eyes. Self-awareness is an enormous challenge, and the tendency of our egos to overwhelm our ability to see ourselves is almost universal. But Judy Gruen is a young woman who I first met over 20 years ago, who she was an ardent Berkeley University-trained left-wing feminist. And she had met a very fine young man who was not only a friend of mine, but he was also a member of my synagogue in California. And he, over a period of time, he had told me about her, and I must confess to my embarrassment today, I told him several times, get rid of her, kick her to the curb, it's just not worth it. You could just spend your whole life is going to be involved in arguments and debates. That's not what you need in a wife. And but he persisted, and he brought her to one of the many Torah classes I taught every week. And I remember her arrival there, but even more importantly, she does in great detail. She's just written and published a book called The Skeptic and the Rabbi. You can see it on our website. You can also see it on Amazon or anywhere else you care to look at books. The Skeptic and the Rabbi by Judy Gruen. Anyways, I found the book absolutely fascinating. She'd asked me if I minded her writing it, and I said, of course not. And she went ahead and tells the story of how a skeptic encountered faith for the first time and fell in love with it. It's a beautiful story. She's a beautiful person, and I thought that you would like to meet her through this show. So when we come back, you will meet Judy Gruen, the author of The Skeptic and the Rabbi. That's it for now. We'll be back with you in just a moment.
Ancient solutions to modern problems. This is Rabbi Daniel Lappin, on demand on the Blaze Radio Network.
You want to save money in a place that gives you growth, control, and certainty without stock market risk or tax risk, and you want guarantees, and you want it all tax-free. That's a tall order. But you can get all of that with properly designed participating whole life insurance. Most people think life insurance pays after you're dead. That's true. But you can have tax-free access to use your life insurance while you're alive. Get the free book to find out how. Call 702-660-7000.
Revealing how the world really works. This is Rabbi Daniel Lappin, on demand on the Blaze Radio Network.
Well, we're connected with Judy Gruen, the author of a book called The Skeptic and the Rabbi. And by the time I have finished talking with you, Judy, I cannot imagine any outcome other than huge Niagara-like cascades of humanity will be pouring out of their houses and heading to the nearest bookstore. Or, of course, today going online and ordering that way. But this is a book that I am wholeheartedly going to promote. I was a little nervous when you started work on this book. Does that make sense to you?
Yes, it does, because you knew that I was the skeptic and you were the rabbi.
That's exactly right. And I was not in the least bit shocked to read on page 89, "For Jeff's sake," that's your now husband, then your boyfriend, "for Jeff's sake, I wanted to like Rabbi Lappin and this whole new world of Torah study and observance, but because the rabbi was both Orthodox and a white South African, I assumed he was racist and sexist. So I also really didn't want to like him."
Well, you know, I have to confess that I went to Berkeley, and Berkeley is much in the news literally today from Ben Shapiro's speaking there last night. And so I had some baggage there regarding your provenance, shall we say.
I know, and I'm just joking, because I really know that leaving aside the white South Africa, I mean, that was just sheer bigotry, right?
It was. I admit it.
Imagine what you know, who today would write, "Well, I was going to visit this doctor, but I believe he was a black Somalian, so I was really ready for an incompetent doctor," you know, or something like that. Nobody would write a thing like that.
No, but I was trying to put myself back in my...
I remember. Yeah.
Yes.
And I will confess something as well, which, and again, I'm sure this is not news to you.
And that is that when, look, Jeff, I loved Jeff then as I do now. Your husband is an absolute prince of men, right?
He is indeed.
Yeah. And so he's telling me about this girl. And there's always a but. Every time he tells me about you, there's a big but. And no, you know, yeah, thank you. He'd love to bring you around. Yeah, thank you for the invitation. You know, I'd love to bring her for dinner, but it's just not the right time yet. But what is the right time? Christmas Eve? What do we have to wait for, you know? No, it's not that, you know. She comes from a different background. Oh, what is she? Buddhist? Hindu? What is she? No, she's Jewish, but it's a different background. What are you talking about? Well, she's a feminist. And it was really one of the first times I began to understand that feminism is another religion. And in many ways, it stands in opposition to conventional Jewish faith. But back then, it wasn't yet clear to me. And then he brought you in and introduced me. And I think the first time we met was at the class, was it not? At the Torah class.
Oh, it absolutely was. I remember just my heart pounding in trepidation walking up the walkway into your home for the shiur, for the class.
Well, you are probably, again, you're such an incredibly self-aware person. And by the way, one of the two best things about this book, in my opinion, are one, it's searing honesty. It's you are so self-aware and so honest. It really gives one a glimpse into you, the real person. And the other part is the humor, which is it comes through. On every single page, you find yourself chuckling. But so you probably won't be surprised to know that my recollection of that evening is that you were radiating such hostility.
Yes.
Now, I will admit.
From the third row up to where you were standing, yes, I'm sorry, I apologize.
No apology necessary. I must tell you, over the years, I seem to have been a lightning rod for that kind of reaction very often indeed. So it's no problem at all, particularly since this particular story turned out so very well. So okay so back to the beginning. Let's just review. So the book is called The Skeptic and the Rabbi, and of course you, the author Judy Gruen, you're the skeptic, I'm the rabbi. And but the book is much more than a story of our meeting and becoming the close friends that we are to the present day. The book is a picture not only of your journey into faith, but in many ways it's also a landscape of a general journey back into faith on the part of a small but significant number of secularized Jews during the 70s and 80s, right?
Yes, that is what I wanted it to be. And I just want to interject what you said a minute ago, which I appreciate so much, that that it is a funny book also. There would have been no point in me writing a book about returning to my faith roots without... Because there were many other people who have done that and who can do it well. The trick for me, and as somebody who's written three humor books and has made a career in emphasizing humor, I wanted to show the humor in it and the ironies abounding, because that would make my story more relatable and real. That was really one of my primary goals.
Yes. Well, I think that certainly did succeed, and it provides a wonderful window into a reality of our times, which is that in both Judaism and Christianity, there are people who came from very little of a faith background who are moving seriously into a committed relationship with God. And one hears about it far more in the Christian communities just because of the numbers. But I really do think that your book is going to become, and is rapidly becoming already, the go-to volume for trying to get a feel for what is really going on inside the Jewish community. Because one of the things that my many Christian friends are puzzled by, and I've often spoken about writing a book called, you know, the five things that Christians don't know about Jews. But then it turned into the 10 things that Christians don't know about Jews. And now it's up to the 27 things that Christians don't know about Jews. And and one of them is they don't get, and this is what I want to ask you to speak a little bit about. They don't get how it is that there are people who identify as Jews. They'll even beat their chests and speak of how proud they are of being Jews and of their Jewish heritage. And yet, they are sublimely clueless about the Torah. What's that all about?
Oh, you know, Rabbi Lapin, I have personally been asked this question by some of my Christian readers, and I'm very proud and pleased that over the years I have developed a little bit of a following among believing Christians, and they have point blank asked me this question: why aren't more Jews, you know, observing the Sabbath like you are? And part of the story that I tell is the slide of assimilation that happened, that is very much, you know, projected through my grandparents. My grandparents are a big part of the story. I love them all. But my European-born grandparents, my mother's parents, like so many of that generation, and admittedly, they came over in the 1920s, they wanted the freedom of America. They wanted not to feel oppressed, which they did for, unfortunately, good reason back in Europe. But then they let a lot of things slide because they wanted their children to be free. But unfortunately, they also let them become free of knowledge.
You started on this journey where your awareness or your knowledge of Orthodox Jews was limited, right? What did you know? What did you think of Orthodox Jews when you met Jeff? What
I had conflicting opinions, and I write this in one of the early sections of the book, that I lived in the same neighborhood where Jeff and I live now, which is a Jewish neighborhood, but I was not keeping the Sabbath, and I would be driving on Saturday toward the mall along one of the major boulevards, where I would be passing Orthodox Jews walking in their Saturday best to or from synagogue, and I felt guilty. Even though I wasn't doing what they were doing, I felt that what they were doing was important, and there was always a part of me that felt that the Orthodox Jews, it was so important that they were around, that they were kind of doing the heavy lifting, so to speak. You know, it was going to be a bridge too far for me, but I was glad somebody was doing it. I had just a deeply ingrained sense that this mattered. I just didn't want it to apply to me, right, which was a very, you know, selfish and shallow opinion.
Right. All right. Well, Judy, what we're going to do is leave it here for just a moment, and we will pick up very shortly as we continue with the story of a book which everyone is going to enjoy. I naturally read it with a little more nervousness and anxiety than most, because I feature in it, but I think it's something everyone will enjoy. We're going to come back and talk a little more about it in just a moment, okay?
All right.
All righty.
This is Rabbi Daniel Lapin on demand on the Blaze Radio Network.
The progressive movement is full of lies. Why do Americans keep falling for the deception? In his new book, Liars, Glenn Beck reveals the simple answer, fear.
At our most basic level, we're all afraid of something, and progressives exploit this by offering us solutions to our fears. Solutions based on lies and an unrelenting hunger for power and control. Understanding the roots of these lies is key to helping us stop the disease of progressivism.
Liars by Glenn Beck. On sale now at glennbeck.com/liars. With stories in the areas of family, friendship, faith, and finance, this is Rabbi Daniel Lapin. Only on the Blaze Radio Network On Demand.
Judy, thanks so much for continuing the conversation. Your book, The Skeptic and the Rabbi, compelling, searingly honest, a true glimpse into your heart, into your soul, into your personality, and above all, into your fascinating story, and a real chuckle producer as one reads through it. There's so much of real life that one recognizes. So, something that Christians discover is that American culture, and American culture is heavily Jewish, right? I mean, you think of some of the shows that have become hit sitcoms, shows like Seinfeld, for instance, and so many others, where the Jewish influence is almost embarrassing. You know, you wonder, who are these 1.3% of the American population who exert such influence that, that a farmer in Kansas is expected to know certain Yiddish words. I mean, it's a very, very Jewish culture. Most Christians do not know much about the sort of inner workings of the Jewish community, and that popular culture knows even less about what things are like in the Christian community. When I say the Christian community, I'm speaking primarily about Bible-believing Christians who are fervent and committed Christians. And I remember the Washington Post ran a story a number of years ago by a Jewish writer in which he described believing Christians as uneducated, poor, and easy to command.
Ugh. It's so patronizing.
It was absolutely amazing. And to their credit, the paper then published something I wrote in response to that, and in which I just pointed a finger at the bigotry and the sheer ignorance. And then I also brought out the statistics that, on average, taken throughout the country, believing Christians are way above the average in educational level, way above the average economically, and among the most independent-minded people imaginable. Now, a lot of people don't get that last thing, because the notion is that if you're religious, you're not independent, you just follow something blindly. Well,
right.
This was certainly something you grappled with. And here's what I'm thinking of specifically. You saw all these Orthodox Jews walking to synagogue on Saturday because they don't drive on the Shabbat, and you're on your way to the mall. And after the mall, you'd have stopped for lunch with a girlfriend somewhere at some restaurant. And if at that point you would have said to somebody, I know this wasn't on your radar, but had you said at that point, you know what, I'm thinking of embracing Orthodox Judaism, and if the friend would have said to you, are you crazy? All of a sudden, Saturday vanishes from your schedule. You're not able to go to the mall with me on Saturday. All of a sudden, no more eating in the restaurants you and I both love. What on earth would you do all of that for? In hindsight, what's your answer? Those are true arguments. Your life changes dramatically. You cannot eat where you like. You can't do what you like, not only on Saturdays, but on every biblical festival. And for heaven's sake, if we don't put too fine a point on it, you can't even sleep with your husband whenever you feel like it.
Right. Well, there are so many answers to this, and that's one reason I wrote the book. But you know, some of the things that you had taught us all those years ago, the line that I've quoted from you so many times, the motto of rules, rituals, and restraints is such a, so elegantly put, but it also allows a framework of a different kind of a freedom. In other words, sure, if I didn't live this life and I had no restraints on my religious ethics or religious obligations, I'm still really not free because I am going to be subject to the whims, the ever-changing whims of the society telling me, you know, eat this today, don't eat that tomorrow, have this kind of relationship today, have that kind of relationship tomorrow. That's not really free either, is it? Because it leads to so much confusion. So it's true. As an Orthodox Jew, we have a lot of rules. We do. There's no sense in denying that. And sometimes it can seem like, oh, really? Do I have to do this now? But if you take the time to really learn what it's all about and have the context for it and to understand that this is really ultimately about a relationship with God, it makes sense. And it's not only doable, but it is life-affirming and beautiful.
And you were a Berkeley-educated feminist. You're no slouch in the academic department. During your journey into faith, which is now a couple of decades old, have there ever been times where you've had to say to yourself, I can't wrap my mind around this one. This one is just a puzzling thing to me. I'm going to go along with it because I'm on the journey. But it just, you know, this rule, this regulation, this aspect of the kosher laws or whatever it is, it just doesn't work for me.
Yes, and in fact, it's one of the chapters in my book where, as you know, of course, married women are expected to cover their hair in public. I could not abide that. I was obsessed by that mitzvah, by that commandment, and I told Jeff over and over again, sorry, I am not doing that. I cannot do it.
Yeah, I remember him telling me that too.
And I didn't do it for a number of years. And what finally got to me, the funny thing was I wanted to do it, but I couldn't. It was just one of those bridges too far. But then our eldest son, Avi, was 3 years old. And as a little boy at 3 years old, he was wearing a yarmulke. And he was wearing the little tzitzit garment. And we expected him to do that, and I couldn't take it anymore. I thought to myself, you're expecting a three-year-old boy to remember to keep his hair, his head covered with the yarmulke, but you're not doing, you know, your mitzvah. How long is it going to be before he asks you, Mommy, you know, why are the other mommies, you know, covering their hair and you're not? And that just really got to me. And I thought, you know something? I don't understand it all. I may not like it, but I'm going to do it. But I kept trying to understand it better so that I wouldn't be resentful. Because if you're doing something under duress only, it's not going to work. And fortunately, over time, I made much more peace with it. Can I say it's my favorite mitzvah? No. But I can say that I'm glad that I rose to the occasion.
Yeah. Why do you think it is, and I'm sure you've noticed this as I do, that Muslim women have absolutely no hesitation in not only appearing in public in with their head coverings on, but actually being quite inflammatory about it and quite assertive about it? I remember there was an issue recently at a DMV for a driver's license picture.
Right.
She didn't, you know, she wasn't talking about covering her face. That's a real issue. But the clerk didn't want her to cover her hair, and she wasn't backing down. Why is it that Muslim women seem to be so much more assertive and confident in this particular area of covering the hair of a married woman like that than we do in our faith?
Oh, gosh, I don't know. That's an impossible question for me to try and get inside the head of a Muslim woman. First of all, I'd have to get through the burqa, and I don't know how I would do that. I don't know. I really don't know. I know that on Facebook, I have recently gotten involved or joined a few private groups that are comprised mostly of Orthodox Jewish women, where they speak very openly about a lot of issues that are pertinent only to them. And I see that there's just a huge amount of diversity of opinion, and certainly diversity in terms of level of comfort and even love of doing certain of the commandments, and I guess that's to be expected. You know, we're a complicated people, Jews are, and there's a lot that God expects from us. I guess we are all doing the best we can, but I believe that, you know, it's a relationship, and the more that we give to that relationship with God, the more we get back. But I'm sorry, I can't answer your question better. I just don't know.
You know, it's just interesting because I must tell you, when I have to pray at an airport or something because the sun is going down, and you know, and my prayers, you know, I mean, I can do an afternoon prayer in about 90 seconds or something, you know, I mean, it's not a big deal, but I must say, I still feel, after all these years, I still feel a little self-conscious, and every now and then I get taught a lesson because, you know, not 10 yards from me, a Muslim guy flings down a little rug, plonks himself on the ground, puts his forehead on the floor, and remains prostrated for 5 minutes. Couldn't care less what anybody thinks. So it's kind of interesting to me.
I think that we as Orthodox Jews have things that we can learn from the Muslims, just as we have things we can learn from religious Christians too. I think that we have things to learn from each other, whether it's from just being very confident in public about who we are, or perhaps with in the Christian world, the way that families will sit down and study Bible together. I think that's a beautiful thing. We have things that we can look around and learn.
Yeah, from absolutely. Quick break. Your book, The Skeptic and the Rabbi, a fabulous read, and particularly for those people listening who are either in a faith moment themselves, perhaps a faith transition, a faith journey, or you are trying to make sure that your children remain committed to the path that you are walking on. This book is not only fascinating, but it is also a very useful resource. And you can get it on our website at rabbidaniellappin.com. You can obviously also get it in every single bookstore in the country. It is very, very popular, and it's caught on incredibly quickly. Okay, till we pick up this conversation again, Judy, thanks so much.
You're listening to Rabbi Daniel Lappin On Demand on the Blaze Radio Network. Find more at theblaze.com/radio.
Pat Gray.
There's a movie out that you haven't seen?
Because movies, I like seeing the movies and watching them, mm-hmm. but I don't like leaving my home.
You don't like leaving your couch,
sir. I don't like leaving my home.
Is that because you need a crane to get out of it? They're going to, like, take out a wall and crane you out of it?
I see what you did there.
No, that's not it at all.
That's not it? Oh, okay. I guess I misunderstood.
Pat Gray. Weekdays noon to 3 Eastern. Only on the Blaze Radio Network.
Welcome back to the Blaze Radio Network On Demand with Rabbi Daniel Lappin.
Hi, everybody. Thanks so much for being part of the Rabbi Daniel Lappin Show. And I hope you enjoyed hearing me talking with Judy Gruen, the author of The Skeptic and the Rabbi. If you did, let me know. And if enough of you enjoyed it, then I will continue. I'll talk to her a little bit more next week. If not, then I won't. But if you liked it, I will. The book is an interesting book, and you can read more about it on our website at rabbidaniellappin.com. Also on the website, I've got a couple of new videos having to do with the biblical festivals that we are celebrating right at the present time. While I am preparing this show, we are in the middle of the high holiday period of the Jewish calendar, and naturally that impacts me. When I spoke earlier in the show about the fact that part of the show's purpose is to help us all, including myself, make us immune to despair and despondency and uplift us through the methodologies of dignity and discipline. That's really an essential part of what I believe my mission here on the Rabbi Daniel Lappin Show is actually all about. But at any rate, that is probably about as far as we can go for this particular show. And so I wish you all a fantastic 5778, a very healthy and productive and good year for each and every one of you. And until next week, I'm afraid, I have to say goodbye, wishing you a week of good health and prosperity. I'm Rabbi Daniel Lappin. Till next week, God bless.
You're listening to Rabbi Daniel Lappin on demand on the Blaze Radio Network. Find more at theblaze.com/radio.